The following article, Astonishing DNA Complexity Demolishes Neo-Darwinism, by Alex Williams from the Journal of Creation, 2007, is a free MP3 audio resource produced by Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB is online at puritandownloads.com. This article is copyrighted by Creation Ministries International, CMI, and is read by permission. Visit Creation Ministries International at creation.com for a massive collection of outstanding free online creationist resources, videos, articles, etc. At Stillwater's Revival Books, we also highly recommend CMI's professionally produced magazine, The Creation Magazine, and The Journal of Creation. We, that is Stillwater's Revival Books, also make thousands of free Christian resources available online at puritandownloads.com. At puritandownloads.com, you'll also find our complete online catalog containing classic and contemporary Christian books, digital downloads, MP3s, videos, books, and the Puritan hard drive at great discounts. And now to SWRB's reading of Astonishing DNA Complexity Demolishes Neo-Darwinism by Alex Williams, remembering that God teaches us in the Bible that the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Romans 1:20 from the KJV. The traditional understanding of DNA has recently been transformed beyond recognition. DNA does not, as we thought, carry a linear, one-dimensional, one-way, sequential code, like the lines of letters and words on this page. And the 97% in humans that does not carry protein-coding genes is not, as many people thought, fossilized junk left over from our evolutionary ancestors. DNA information is overlapping, multilayered, and multidimensional. It reads both backwards and forwards. And the, quote, junk is far more functional than the protein code, so there is no fossilized history of evolution. No human engineer has ever been imagined, let alone designed, an information storage device, anything like it. Moreover, the vast majority of its content is meta-information, information about how to use information. Meta-information cannot arise by chance, because it only makes sense in context of the information it relates to. And finally, 95% of its functional information shows no sign of having been naturally selected. On the contrary, it is rapidly degenerating. That means Darwin was wrong. Natural selection of natural variation does not explain the variety of life on Earth. The best explanation is what the Bible tells us. We were created, as evidenced by the marvels of DNA, but then we fell, and now endure the curse of bondage to decay by mutations. Neo-Darwinian history of life first. The Neo-Darwinian theory of evolution says that all life on Earth arose from a common ancestor via random mutations to genes that survived natural selection. Organisms with beneficial mutations produced more offspring. Those with deleterious mutations produced less or no offspring. Some beneficial mutations provided new adaptations to new or changed environments, thereby producing new kinds of organisms. In order to get extra new information that was needed to build more complex organisms, existing genes must have been duplicated and then mutated into something useful. This error-ridden process was not very efficient, and it left behind in our genomes lots of genetic fossil junk. mutations that were neutral and not selected out, duplicated genes that didn't make it, and functional genes that mutated beyond their usefulness. That was the junk. As a result, our evolutionary history is woven into the fabric of modern life, inscribed in its coded characters. This code, of course, is on the DNA molecule in the form of a long string of letters consisting of four base molecules, commonly represented by the initials T, A, G, and C. The code was thought to be written in a straightforward manner, like the letters and words on a page. Neo-Darwinian molecular taxonomists routinely use this, quote, junk DNA as a molecular clock. A silent record of mutations that have been undisturbed by natural selection for millions of years because it does not do anything. They've constructed elaborate evolutionary histories for all different kinds of life from it. How wrong this has all proved to be. The ENCODE Project. When the Human Genome Project published its first draft of the human genome in 2003, they already knew certain things in advance. These included coding segments, that is, genes that coded for proteins, were a minor component of the total amount of DNA in each cell. It was embarrassing to find that we have only about as many genes as mice, about 25,000, which constitute only about 3% of our entire genome. The remaining 97% was of largely unknown function, probably the junk referred to above. Genes were known to be functional segments of DNA, exons, interspersed with non-functional segments, introns, of unknown purpose. When the gene is copied, transcribed into RNA, and then translated into protein, the introns are spliced out, and the exons are joined up to produce the functional protein-producing gene. Copying or transcription of the gene began at a spatially marked start position and ended at a special stop sign. Another thing we knew, gene switches, the molecules involved are collectively called transcription factors, were located on the chromosome adjacent to the start end of the gene. Next, transcription proceeds one way, from the start end to the stop end. And then genes were scattered throughout the chromosomes, somewhat like beads on a string, although some areas were gene-rich and others gene-poor. And then DNA is a double helix molecule, somewhat like a coiled zipper. Each strand of the DNA zipper is the complement of the other. As on a clothing zipper, one side has a lump that fits into a cavity on the other strand. Only one side is called the sense strand, and the complementary strand is called the anti-sense strand. Protein production usually only comes from copying the sense strand. The antisense strand provides a template for copying the sense strand in a way that a photographic negative is used to produce a positive print. Some exceptions to this rule were known. In some cases, antisense strands were used to make protein. This whole structure of understanding was turned on its head by a project called ENCODE that recently reported an intensive study of the transcripts, the copies of RNA produced from the DNA, of just 1% of the human genome. Their findings include the following inferences. First, about 93% of the genome is transcribed, not 3% as expected. Further study with more wide-ranging methods may raise this figure to 100%. Because much energy and coordination is required for transcription, this means that probably the whole genome is used by the cell, and there is no such thing as junk DNA. Next, exons are not gene specific, but are modules that can be joined to many different RNA transcripts. One exon, that is a protein-making portion of one gene, can be used in combination with up to 33 different genes located on as many as 14 different chromosomes. This means that one exon can specify one part shared in common by many different proteins. Next, there is no beads on a string linear arrangement of genes, but rather an interleaved structure of overlapping segments with typically 5, 7 or more transcripts coming from just one segment of code. Next, not just one strand, but both strands, sense and antisense, of the DNA are fully transcribed. And then transcription proceeds not just one way, but both backwards and forwards. Also, transcription factors can be tens or hundreds of thousands of base pairs away from the gene that they control, and even on different chromosomes. Next, there is not just one start site, but many in each particular gene region. And finally, there's not just one transcription triggering or switching system for each region, but many. And so the authors concluded, an interleaved genomic organization poses important mechanistic challenges for the cell. One involves the use of the same DNA molecules for multiple functions. The overlap of functionally important sequence motifs must be resolved in time and space for this organization to work properly. Another challenge is the need to compartmentalize RNA or mask RNAs that could potentially form long double-stranded regions to prevent RNA-RNA interactions that could prompt apoptosis, programmed cell death. Well, the problem of using the same code to produce many different functional transcripts means that DNA cannot be endlessly mutable, as neo-Darwinists assume. Most mutations are deleterious, and so mutations in such a complex structure would quickly destroy many functions at once. Their concern for the safety of so many RNA molecules in such a small space is also well-founded. RNA is a long single-strand molecule, not unlike a long piece of sticky tape. It will stick to any nearby surface, including itself. Unless properly coordinated, it will quickly tie itself up into a sticky mess. These results are so astonishing, so shocking, that it is going to take an awful lot more work and research to untangle what's really going on in cells. A functional junk. The ENCODE project did confirm that genes still form the primary information needed by the cell, the protein-producing code, even though much greater complexity has now been uncovered. Genes found in the ENCODE project differ only about 2% from the existing catalog. The astonishing discovery of multiple overlapping transcripts in every part of the DNA was amazing in itself, but the extent of the overlaps are huge compared to the size of a typical gene. On average, the transcripts are 10 to 50 times the size of a typical gene region overlapping on both sides, and as many as 20% of transcripts range up to more than 100 times the size of a typical gene region. This would be like photocopying a page in a book and having to get information from 10, 50, or even 100 other pages in order to use the information on that one page. The non-protein coding regions, previously thought to be junk, are now called untranslated regions, UTRs, because while they are transcribed into RNA, they're not translated into protein. Not only has the ENCODE project elevated UTRs out of the junk category, but it now appears that they are far more active than the translated regions, the genes, as measured by the number of DNA bases appearing in RNA transcripts. Genic regions are transcribed on average in five different overlapping and interleaved ways, while UTRs are transcribed on average in seven different overlapping and interleaved ways. Since there are about 33 times as many bases in UTRs than in genic regions, that makes the junk about 50 times more active than the genes. Transcription activity can best be predicted by just one factor: the way that the DNA is packaged into chromosomes. The DNA is coiled around protein globules called histones, then coiled again into a rope-like structure, then supercoiled in two stages around scaffold proteins to produce the thick chromosomes that we see under the microscope. The resulting DNA protein complex is called chromatin. This suggests that DNA information normally exists in a form similar to a closed book. All the coiling prevents the coded information from coming into contact with the translation machinery. When the cell wants some information, it opens a particular page, photocopies the information, and then closes the book again. Recent other work shows that this is physically accomplished as follows. First, the chromosomes in each cell are stored in the membrane-bound nucleus. The nuclear membrane has about 2,000 pores in it, through which molecules need permission to pass in and out. The required chromosome is brought near to one of these nuclear pores. Second, the section of DNA to be transcribed is placed in front of the pore. Third, the supercoil is unwound to expose the transcription region. Next, the histone coils are twisted to expose the required copying site. And then, the double helix of the DNA is unzipped to expose the coded information. Next, the DNA is grasped into a loop by the enzymes that do the copying, and this loop is copied onto an RNA transcript. The transcript is then checked for accuracy and is corrected or degraded and recycled if it is faulty. Accurate RNA transcripts are then specially tagged for export through the pore and are carried to wherever they are needed in the cell. And finally, the book of DNA information is then closed by a reversal of the coiling process and movement of the chromosome away from the nuclear pore region. This astonishing discovery that the so-called junk regions are far more functionally active than the gene regions suggests that probably none of the human genome is inactive junk. Junk is, by definition, useless, or at least presently unused. But UTRs are being actively used right now. That means they're not fossils of bygone evolutionary ages. They're being used right now because they're needed right now. If other animals have similar DNA sequences, it means they have similar needs that we do. This is sound logic based upon observable biology, as opposed to the fanciful mutational suppositions of neo-Darwinism. The molecular taxonomists who have been drawing up evolutionary histories, phylogenies, for nearly every kind of life, are going to have to undo all their years of junk DNA-based historical reconstructions and wait for the full implications to emerge before they try again. One of the supposedly knocked-down arguments that humans have a common ancestor with chimpanzees is shared non-functional DNA coding. Well, that argument is now out the window. Multiple codes. A major outcome of the studies so far is that there are multiple information codes operating in living cells. The protein code is the simplest and has been studied for half a century. But a number of other codes are now known, at least by inference. First, the cell memory code. DNA is a very long, thin molecule. If you unwound the DNA from just one human cell, it would be about 2 meters long. To squash this into a tiny cell nucleus, the DNA is wound up in four separate layers of chromatin structure, as described earlier. The first level of this chromatin structure carries a histone code that contains information about the cell's history. That is, it is a cell memory. The DNA is coiled twice around a group of 8 histone molecules, and a 9th histone pins this structure into place to form what is called a nucleosome. These nucleosomes can carry various chemical modifications that either allow or prevent the expression of the DNA wrapped around them. Every time a cell divides into 2 new cells, its DNA double helix splits into 2 single strands, which then each produce a new double strand. But nucleosomes are not duplicated like the DNA strands. Rather, they're distributed between either one or the other of the 2 new DNA double strands, and the empty spaces are filled by new nucleosomes. Cell division is therefore an opportunity for changes in the nucleosomal composition of a specific DNA region. Changes can also happen during the lifetime of a cell due to chemical reactions allowing interconversions between the different nucleosome types. The memory effect of these changes can be that a latent capacity that was dormant comes to life, or conversely, a previously active capacity shuts down. Then there's the differentiation code. In humans, there are about 300 different cell types in our bodies that make up the different tissue types: nerves, blood, muscle, liver, spleen, eyes, etc. All of these cells contain the same DNA. So how does each cell know how to become a nerve cell rather than a blood cell? The required information is written in code down the side of the DNA double helix in the form of different molecules attached to the nucleotides that form the rungs in the ladder of the helix. This code silences developmental genes in embryonic stem cells, but preserves their potential to become activated during embryogenesis. The embryo itself is largely defined by its DNA sequence, but its subsequent development can be altered in response to lineage specific transcriptional programs and environmental cues, and is epigenetically maintained. Next is the replication code. The replication code was discovered by addressing the question of how cells maintain their normal metabolic activity, which continually uses the DNA as source information when it comes time for cell division. The key problem is that a large proportion of the whole genome is required for the normal operation of the cell, probably at least 50% in unspecialized body cells and up to 70 or 80% in complex liver and brain cells. And, of course, the whole genome is required during replication. This creates a huge logistic problem: how to avoid clashes between the transcription machinery, which needs to continually copy information for ongoing use in the cell, and the replication machinery, which needs to unzip the whole of the DNA double helix and replicate a zipped copy back onto each of the separated strands. The cell solution to this logistics nightmare is truly astonishing. Replication does not begin at any one point, but at thousands of different points. But of these thousands of potential start points, only a subset are used in any one cell cycle. Different subsets are used at different times and places. A full understanding is yet to emerge because the system is so complex. However, some progress has been made as follows. First, the large set of potential replication start sites is not essential, but optional. In early embryogenesis, for example, before any transcription begins, the whole genome replicates numerous times without any reference to the special set of potential start sites. Next, the pattern of replication in the late embryo and adult is tissue-specific. This suggests that cells in a particular tissue cooperate by coordinating replication so that while part of the DNA in one cell is being replicated, the corresponding part in a neighboring cell is being transcribed. Transcripts can thus be shared so that normal functions can be maintained throughout the tissue while different parts of the DNA are being replicated. Third, DNA that is transcribed early in the cell division cycle is also replicated in the early stage, but the transcription and replication machines are carefully kept apart. The early transcribed DNA is that which is needed most often in cell function. The correlation between transcription and replication in this early phase allows the cell to minimize the downtime in transcription of the most urgent supplies while replication takes place. Next, there's a pecking order of control. Preparation for replication may take place at thousands of different locations, but once replication does begin at a particular site, it suppresses replication at nearby sites so that only one copy of the DNA is made. If transcription happens to occur nearby, replication is suppressed until transcription is completed. This clearly demonstrates that keeping the cell alive and functioning properly takes precedence over cell division. Fifth, there is a built-in error correction system called the cell cycle checkpoints. If replication proceeds without any problems, correction is not needed. However, if too many replication events occur at once, the potential for conflict between transcription and regulation increases, and/or it may indicate that some replicators have stalled because of errors. Once the threshold number is exceeded, the checkpoint system is activated. The whole process is slowed down, and errors are corrected. If too much damage occurs, the daughter cells will be mutant, or the cell's self-destruct mechanism, the apoptosome, will be activated to dismantle the cell and recycle its components. An obvious benefit of the pattern of replication initiation being never the same from one cell division to the next is that it prevents accumulation of any errors that are not corrected. The exact location of the replication code is yet to be pinpointed, but because it involves transcription factors gaining access to transcription sites, and this is known to be controlled by chromatin structure, then the code itself is probably written into the chromatin structure. Undiscovered codes? Given that we now have at least 4 known codes, it seems reasonable to infer that at least 3 other major activities in cells have a yet undiscovered coded basis. First, regulatory codes. At least some, and perhaps all, of the untranslated regions are involved in gene regulation in one form or another. According to Kirschner and Gerhardt's facilitated variation theory, regulatory information is organized into modules that they liken to Lego blocks. That is, they have strong internal integrity, hard to break, but they're easily pulled apart during meiosis and rearranged into new combinations at fertilization. This built-in capacity for variation, they claim, is essential for life to persist, that is, survive stress in any one generation and evolve down the generations. It therefore seems reasonable to expect to find some code associated with module structure, the rules by which rearrangements can occur, and the constraints that must apply in order to maintain normal metabolic functions in the face of rearranged regulatory circuits. And then transcription code. The most common activity associated with DNA is transcription. But how does a transcription signal know which version of a transcript is required? For any given gene, there are numerous different transcript starting sites, a number of different overlap options, and numerous different signal molecules that can trigger a transcription request. But only one transcription machine can operate on a given segment of DNA at any one time. And there's the nerve code. Nerve cells carry information internally via electrical impulses, but then communicate with one another by converting electrical impulses into neurotransmitter chemicals that then diffuse across the gap, the synapse, between them. There must be a code involved in conversion from electrical to chemical transcription information. Meta-information, an impossible conundrum for evolution. The astonishing complexity of the dynamic information storage capacity of the DNA chromosome system is, in itself, a marvel of engineering design. Such a magnificent solution to such a monster logistics problem could surely only come from a master designer. But the nature of the majority of this information poses an impossible conundrum for neo-Darwinists. Proteins are the workhorse molecules of biology. But protein-coding genes make up only a tiny proportion of all the information that we have been describing above. The vast majority of information in the human genome is not primary code for proteins, but meta-information, information about information. The instructions that a cell needs for using the proteins to make, maintain, and reproduce functional human beings. Neo-Darwinists say that all this information arose by random mutations, but this is not possible. Random events are, by definition, independent of one another. But meta-information is, by definition, totally dependent upon the information to which it relates. It would be quite nonsensical to take the cooking instructions for making a cake and apply them to the assembly of, say, a child's plastic toy. If nothing else, the baking stage would reduce the toy to a mangled mess. Cake cooking instructions only have meaning when applied to cake-making ingredients. And so, too, the logistics solution to the cell division problem is only relevant to the problem of cell division. If we applied the logistics solution to the problem of mate attraction via pheromones, scent, in moths, it would not work. All the vast amount of meta-information in the human genome only has meaning when applied to the problem of using the human genome to make, maintain, and reproduce human beings. Even if we granted that the first biological information came into existence by a random process in an RNA world scenario, the meta-information needed to use that information could not possibly come into existence by the same random or independent process, because meta-information is inextricably dependent upon the information that it relates to. There is thus no possible random mutation solution to this conundrum. Can natural selection save the day? No. There are at least 100, and probably many more, bits of meta-information in the human genome for every one bit of primary, that is, protein-coding gene information. An organism that has to manufacture, maintain, and drag around with it a mountain of useless mutations while waiting for a chance correlation of relevance to occur so that something useful can happen, is an organism that natural selection is going to select against, not favor. Moreover, an organism that can survive long enough to accumulate a mountain of useless mutations is an organism that does not need useless mutations. It must already have all the information it needs to survive. What kind of organism has all the information it needs to survive? There's only one answer. An organism that was created in the beginning with all that it needs to survive. What kind of information is this? These results present us with a spectacle never before encountered in science. An information structure so complex that it defies description. How can we possibly understand it? I believe there are at least two things that we can reasonably conclude about it at this time. First, it is most decidedly not the one-dimensional linear sequence of characters that neo-Darwinists need to provide the endlessly mutable source of universal evolution. While it is certainly variable, its extraordinarily complex structure cannot possibly be endlessly mutable because a certain amount of invariance is required to maintain complex structure. Otherwise, it quickly degrades into error catastrophe. The experimentally verified universally deleterious nature of mutations supports this conclusion. Second thing we can conclude is that according to Kirschner and Gerhardt's theory of facilitated variation, DNA contains regulatory-based modules, which they liken to Lego blocks. That is, they have very strong internal coherence and integrity, as we said, difficult to break, but are easily pulled apart during meiosis and reassembled during fertilization to produce a built-in capacity for variation. To understand it properly, we need to locate the Lego blocks and the boundaries between them. Natural selection, irrelevant. The most surprising result of the ENCODE project, according to its authors, is that 95% of the functional transcripts, that's genic and UTR transcripts with at least one known function, show no sign of selection pressure. That is, they're not noticeably conserved and are mutating at the average rate. Why were they surprised? Because man is supposed to have evolved from ape-like ancestors via mutation and natural selection. But if 95% of the human functional information shows no sign of natural selection, then it means that natural selection has not been a significant contributor to our ancestry. While this result surprised the neo-Darwinists, it is perfectly in line with current research in human genetics. In his groundbreaking exposé of current knowledge, Genetic Entropy and the Mystery of the Genome, geneticist Dr. John Sanford of Cornell University showed that deleterious mutations are accumulating at an alarming rate in the human population, and that both natural selection and even the worst possible nightmare scenario of eugenics is powerless to stop it. This is because the vast majority are deleterious single nucleotide mutations that have a minuscule effect on fitness So natural selection cannot detect them amongst the noise and thus is unable to delete them. Also, there's so much other information contributing to fitness, and life always has many different ways of achieving its goals. Natural selection is also powerless to delete numerous mutations simultaneously because their effects on fitness are complex, interactive, and often mutually interfering. Natural selection only works in simple cases that are easy to explain in textbooks. One organism with one big defect will fail to reproduce. Alternately, one big strong male will outcompete his rivals and fertilize more females, thus improving the overall genetic well-being of the species. These kinds of scenarios only have a minor impact on the human population. Most of us are just mediocre, but most of us do find partners and procreate. If the average number of deleterious mutations per person per generation is much less than one, then we have some hope that natural selection might favor the strong over the weak and keep our species genetically healthy. But in fact, the average number of deleterious mutations per person per generation is very much greater than one, probably at least 100 per person per generation, likely about 300 and perhaps much more. This means that everyone is a mutant many times over, and natural selection is powerless to stop it because deleting the weakest, whatever that might mean, will do nothing to prevent everyone else reproducing, resulting in an inexorable degeneration of the whole human population. Even the most horrible eugenics program could not stop it. This problem caused one author to write a paper entitled, "Why Are We Not Dead?" 100 times over. Let's now put this information together with Haldane's dilemma. Famous geneticist J.B.S. Haldane calculated that it would take about 300 generations for a favorable mutation to become fixed in a population, every member having a double copy of it. He calculated that in the approximately 6 million years since our supposed hominid ancestor split from the chimpanzee line, only about 1,000, less than 2,000 according to Ramin, such mutations could become fixed. This is certainly not nearly enough to turn an ape into a human. But most importantly, we now know that there are about 125 million single nucleotide differences between humans and chimps, resulting from about 40 million mutational events. This means that somewhere between 39,998,000 and 124,998,000 deleterious changes have occurred since the split with our common ancestor. This means we have degenerated from chimps, which makes a mockery of the whole mutation selection theory of origin. Conclusion: the discovery that virtually all our DNA is functional right now demolishes the neo-Darwinian argument that it contains mostly junk, which constitutes a unique fossilized history of our genetic evolution. The most logical explanation of shared DNA between different kinds of organisms is now shared function, not shared ancestry. The discovery that DNA contains astonishingly complex information structures beyond our capacity to even imagine, let alone comprehend, means that neo-Darwinism's total dependence upon random mutations in linear code as a source of new information is in error. We would expect random mutations to extremely complex information structures to be deleterious. This is exactly the universal result of many years of genetic research. Kirshner and Gerhardt's theory that natural variation is largely the result of random rearrangements, specially structured gene modules, is a far more reasonable explanation. The discovery that the vast majority of the information stored in DNA is not primary protein-coded information, but secondary meta-information, demolishes the neo-Darwinian argument that it arose by some random or independent process. Meta-information is inextricably dependent upon the information it refers to, so an independent origin is impossible. The discovery that natural selection has been an insignificant factor in our genetic history demolishes Darwin's theory that all life on Earth arose from a common ancestor by means of the natural selection of natural variation. This discovery is also completely consistent with the genetic evidence that the human genome is degenerating at an alarming rate. Neo-Darwinian theory was a mirage built from ideology upon a few general facts, natural selection, genes, and mutations. But now that we have glimpsed just some of the vast molecular detail of how life actually works, the mirage has evaporated.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwater's Revival Books.